Okay, let me explain to you briefly what we're going to be doing in this session. I want to give you a quick introduction to the subject of this ministry, and then generally the subject of widowhood, and then I want to get into heaven's perspective about widowhood. Because remember, when we see something the way God sees it, we have wisdom about that subject. And that's really what this particular session is all about. The baby that became my wife was born in Dover, Ohio, which is about an hour south of Cleveland in northeast Ohio, in September of 1952, and we were married for 41 years. We were blessed with three daughters, and they were raised right because they have shirts that say, God first, then family, then the Ohio State Buckeyes. All three of them are faithful members of the church. Deanna, who's with us outside of Atlanta area, and she has three daughters. I have, my oldest daughter is up in the Nashville area, Smyrna, Tennessee. And then also my middle daughter is down in Gainesville, Florida. And all three of them have awfully good husbands, and all of them are involved in the Widowhood Workshop Ministry. We were blessed with five grandchildren. This picture was taken, I think, about 18 months after she passed away, on a hill in Dover, Ohio, which is the same city where she was born and the same city where she graduated from high school. Can you imagine being in a hospital bed in your house and having a grandchild of yours laid in that hospital bed and you not having the ability to raise your arms to hug the child? Have you ever thanked the Lord for the ability to hug? Have you ever thanked the Lord for the ability to get up out of bed? To be able to get up out of a chair by yourself? Go to the bathroom by yourself? Take a shower by yourself? Feed yourself? Even eat? When I brought my wife home from the hospital on July the 14th of 2013, I stood in front of the oven and had what Deanna calls a come to Jesus meeting. Something struck me. I brought her home on that date because she finally consented with eye contact, without words, because she couldn't speak. Because she was starving to death and dehydrating, consented to a feeding tube. And so I brought her home on July 14 of 2013. So I was standing in front of the oven, and this is what struck me. All the time that we'd been married, and we'd always thank the Lord for our food before we ate, never once did I end that prayer thank the Lord for our ability to eat. She was never going to be able to eat. She couldn't swallow. Do you know there are people in this world who cannot eat? Donuts or anything else for that matter. But we have the ability to eat. Some people can't eat because they don't have any food. Some people can't eat because physically they can't eat. They can't chew their food and they can't swallow it. I mention all of those things because my wife lost all of those things. And isn't it sad how we human beings are that a lot of times we don't really appreciate something until we lose it? Isn't that sad? I think we're all a little bit that way. We have a lot of blessings. We always have more blessings than burdens. No matter how we feel, we always have more blessings than we have burdens. But she died on Christmas morning of 2013 at 9:40 in the morning. And eventually that gave birth to the Widowhood Workshop Ministry, my family's passion project. My three daughters, my three sons-in-law, my five grandchildren are all a part of this ministry. All of them have responsibilities. This picture was taken at the annual retreat last year in July. In July of last year, we host, this was the sixth year that we hosted a widowhood retreat. And last year we had 158 widowed people from 15 different states who were there. and it's all about encouragement. Something dawned on me after my wife passed away. We have ladies' days. We have senior citizen rallies. We have youth camps. We have marriage seminars. Why have we never had a widowhood retreat? And so I asked my kids if they'd buy in. And sure enough, they bought in. Can you imagine that? You women, you men, we can't recognize this challenge. Can you imagine you women hosting an event that you have nothing in the way of history to go on about how many you're going to have? And your father, who's chairman of the board of the Widowhood Workshop Ministry, says, we are not going to require RSVPs. They had no idea how many were going to come. But we set it up in such a way as that we had a safety net in waiting if we needed it. And we had a great launch. I think we had about 65 or so at that very first one. But it is a way of getting widowed people together and providing encouragement to them and helping them to build their social network with people who can be really, really helpful to them in their social network. Do you know the typical widowed person, when they lose their spouse, loses 75% of their social network? They need to rebuild their social network. That's why the WINGS program here is so important. It helps people rebuild their social network. We're going to be talking about the state, the marital state of a person after they've lost their mate by death. Now, we're a minority. People who are widowed are a minority. And again, keep in mind that for most people, not all, but for most people, the greatest loss of their life is going to be the loss of their marital mate. About 6% of the population, but look at that, 65 years and older, 1/3 of the population. Now, if you break that down, male and female, there are way more than 1/3 of all women 65 years and older are widowed, 12% of the men. If you drop that down to 55%, almost 1/3 of the women 55 years and older are widowed, 9% of the men. The total number is in the neighborhood of 15 million. Now, there are obviously way more widowed females than widowed males, about 4 to 5 times more widowed females than widowed males. Well over 1 million people annually lose their spouse, and 6% of them typically are under 44 years old. 78% of the widowed are women. Now, let me explain to you why that's the case. I'll give you two truths and then two interpretations of those truths. The first truth is, statistically, the lifespan of a woman is longer than the lifespan of a man. Now, my explanation for that is, us guys take care of you girls so good, you live way longer than we do, okay? So we accept blame for that. Now, the second truth is that, statistically, women often marry men who are older than they are. That is totally the blame of the female gender. But those two facts is what contributes to a lot of widowed females and very few widowed males. Most of the research is geared toward widowhood from a female perspective. If you look at a lot of the vast majority of books written by about widowhood are written by women. And that's one reason after my wife died, I decided to write 3 small books, one that's called Before the End Comes, one that's called When the End Comes, and one that's called After the End Comes. Each of them are small books because I know we're losing our reader culture in our world. And so I wanted to write 3 unintimidating small books where even a non-reader person might be willing to pick up that book and read it. But I thought there needed to be more written, especially in the Brotherhood, about this subject that's so personal, that's experienced not only by females, but by males too. And so I wanted to make a contribution in that regard. Now, in the world, there's approximately 245 million widowed females. 115 of them live in abject poverty. One of the most heart-crushing articles I've ever read in print was in the National Geographic in February of 2017. There's an article in this National Geographic magazine about the widowed females in India. When I read that article, I thought, I cannot believe that human beings would be treated like that in our day and age. It is awful. One of the things that we need to do in regard to our missionaries all over the world is we need to make sure that they understand how that we need to create ministries consistent with what God wants in regard to the widowed. In China, they have the most widowed people, widowed females of any nation on planet Earth, 44 million. And in India, they're just about 500,000 below that, about 43 plus million in India. Again, in our country, about 15 million. Are we ministering to the widowed in our domestic and foreign missionary efforts or in our local communities? Now, I want to ask you to think out loud with me together about this. God describes himself as a defender, a reliever, and a protector of the widowed. And I want to ask you, what does that say about God and the widowed? What, he loves them? Okay, what else? He loves, he cares, what else? Okay, he intends for us, for the church, to take care of them. Okay. Why in the world would he be a defender, reliever, and protector? Why are the widowed a big deal to him, apparently? Okay. He knows that they are vulnerable. Now, let me give you a math equation for effective ministry to the widowed or anybody else for that matter. Knowledge plus compassion equals compassion, effective ministry. Knowledge plus compassion equals effective ministry. Now, you drop either one of those two prior to the equal sign, and you're not going to get effective ministry. Now, can you think of people in your life that you have compassion for? Do you think there's any of those people that you don't know what's going on in their life? And because of that, you're not effectively ministering to them? We all have people like that in our lives. People that we're unaware of what's going on in their life for one reason or the other. But we have a compassionate heart. One of the things I think that we need to do a better job of cultivating in the Lord's church is transparency. A level of fellowship, a quality of fellowship, where we would be willing to admit to our brothers and sisters that we're a mess, that we're struggling, that we need help. Some of us were raised by parents who taught us to be independent. Did you know there's an independence to a fault level? Sometimes we are independent to a fault. If I hear one more guy say, well, Dean, you just got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, I think I'm going to slap him. That's independent to a fault. Sometimes we don't know what's going on in people's lives. I was over in Seymour, Tennessee, doing a workshop somewhat similar to this, but a little different. Tom Miller assigned me some unusual topics. And the Sunday morning sermon, there were two females that responded. I was so touched by this experience. The one was a young lady in her mid-20s probably, and she was bawling her eyes out. She was a mess. You know why she responded to the invitation? Her mom and dad were getting a divorce. Her mom was at church that morning. And her mom has an awful story about her marriage. The second lady who came forward that morning was an older lady who was caregiving, and she was at her wit's end. I could really relate to her because I felt like that too at times during that 8.5 year period in my life when I was a caregiver. And that caregiver came and asked for the help of the church because she was struggling. If she had never come forward and explained why she came forward, she would have robbed herself of great help. Now, the people who then responded to her, how do you think that made them feel when they jumped in to help her? How do you feel when you help somebody? How does that make you feel? Good, really good. Have you ever thought about how that if we deprive people of helping us, we are depriving them of the joy that we have received when other people have permitted us to help them? We need to be more transparent about when we're not okay and be willing to accept help and be even willing to ask for help. Let me tell you about Marlene McCoyne. She was a widow lady in Hartville, Ohio, and anytime I go back in that area, I always pick out a few widowed people to visit with, and I went to see Marlene. Marlene's husband's name was Addo, and he was known at church for crazy socks. So we talked about Addo, and we talked about their life together, and we had a great visit together. And before I left, I found out that she had a light that wouldn't come on when she flipped the switch. And before I left, I got up from where I was sitting, and I said, Marlene, I want to check this light out before I leave. She said, oh, don't mess with it. It's okay. I said, no, Marlene, I want to check out this light. She said, no, don't bother with it. I looked at her and I said, Marlene, if you don't let me look at this light, I'm going to move in with you. She said, there's the stool. Do you know what she needed? A light bulb changed. But she wasn't going to let me help until finally I broke her with the threat of moving in with her. I don't know how many of you have sung this song recently. I haven't sung this song in a public assembly for years. Christ has no hands but our hands to do His work today. He has no feet but our feet to lead men in His way. He has no tongue but our tongues to tell men how He died. He has no help but our help to bring them to His side. How does God defend, relieve, and protect the widowed? Well, His book is great in that regard. But then also, there's His people. We're God's huggers, God's lovers, God's supporters, God's encouragers. But if we don't know what's going on in a person's life, we can't do that effectively. So we do need to be more apparent when we are in need. And we also need to make it a point of showing enough interest in people and what's going on in their life, that we research what those kind of people need who are going through that kind of an issue. Don't ever say to a person, I want to discourage you. I guess I shouldn't be so extreme. I shouldn't say don't ever. Let me discourage you from saying something, asking a question to somebody who you think seems to be struggling. What can I do for you? When you ask that question, what burden have you added to an already burdened person's life? They've got to think about what you can do to help them. How about us? How about we do the homework to find out people who are struggling with that particular issue, what are they going through and what kinds of things can we do to help them? And instead of burdening them, how about us just jumping in and doing what we can find out? People who are struggling with that issue, what are the kinds of things that they need? Doing that is helping God to be that defender, reliever, and protector. God knows and God cares. And when you know and care, that results in effective ministry. Now, the Psalms say that the wicked slay the widow. In Job 22, when those miserable comforters claim that Job had sent widows away empty, what's interesting is in chapter 29, he said, I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. See, they were accusing him of something that wasn't true and actually wounding him with their words. Now, in Deuteronomy chapter 24, I would not, if I'd been God, I don't think I would have done this, what God did in Deuteronomy 24. Because if they're going to be crossing the Jordan River and they're going to go into the Canaan land and they're going to have to blow the doors off these barbarian heathen people who were very military engaged in their histories, I would have sent an email to Moses and I would have given him maps and marked strategic locations and given him rules of engagement. But instead of that, God has Moses talk to his people, the Israelites, about here's how I want you to be and here's how I want you to behave. Now watch this passage. Here's how I want you to be, here's how I want you to behave. Deuteronomy 24, verse 17, starting. You shall not pervert justice to the stranger or the fatherless, nor take a widow's garment as a pledge. Three life circumstances in that passage. Now, depending on your translation, stranger or foreigner, fatherless or orphan, and then the widowed. What do those three life circumstances have in common? There's a thread that ties them all together. Okay, different forms of loss. What else? They're alone. They're in uniquely difficult life circumstances, right? Uniquely difficult life circumstances. God knows and God cares. He wants people helped who are in uniquely difficult life circumstances. Now, a number of times in the Bible, these three things are mentioned together. Sometimes two of the three are mentioned together. Now, I am not going to suggest that these are the specific, detailed, only ones that God wants us to be careful to help, or that God was directing the Israelites only to deal with these three kinds of people, with these three circumstances. Some of you English people, do you remember what a synecdoche is? You know, ranchers, they talk about how many cattle do you have? And the guy responds, I have 300 head, a part standing for the whole. I think the idea here is about generally being compassionate toward people who are in uniquely difficult life circumstances. He picks out these three. Now, look right after those three categories are mentioned, and he tells them not to pervert justice to them. By the way, this is truly social justice in the eyes of God. You know, we hear a lot about social justice. This is social justice in the eyes of God. But you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt. Now, were they struggling? Did they have uniquely difficult life circumstances? He brings that up. But you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. Therefore, I command you to do this thing. When you reap your harvest in your field and forget a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back and get it. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat your olive trees, you shall not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not glean it afterwards. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. And you shall remember verse 18, now verse 22, and you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, therefore I command you to do this thing. Why did he bring up Egypt? Twice he brought up Egypt. Why did he bring that up in that context? They were in trouble. They were in big trouble. God compassionately responded. He says, this is the way I treated you. Now you treat other people the same way, especially people who are in uniquely challenging life circumstances. Now, the sad thing is that when you flip over to Isaiah, they didn't listen very good. As a matter of fact, God sends Isaiah to them, and Isaiah confronts them and creates for them a come-to-Jesus kind of meeting. In Isaiah chapter 1, they are described in verse 4 as a sinful nation, a brood of evildoers and corruptors. As a matter of fact, he refers to them as Sodom and Gomorrah in verse 10 of Isaiah chapter 1, and then drop down to verse 12. When you come to appear before me, who has required this from your hand to trample my courts? Bring no more futile sacrifices. Incense is an abomination to me. The new moons and Sabbaths and the calling of assemblies, I cannot endure iniquity. And the sacred meeting, your new moons and your appointed feasts, my soul hates. They are a trouble to me. I'm weary of bearing them. When you spread out your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not hear. Your hands are full of blood. So now he challenges them to repent. When he gets specific, Watch what he mentions. Wash yourselves, make yourselves clean, put away the evil of your doings from before my eyes, cease to do evil, learn to do good, seek justice, rebuke the oppressor, defend the fatherless, plead for the widow. And then in verse 23, he says, your princes are rebellious and companions of thieves. Everyone loves bribes and follows after rewards. They do not defend the fatherless, nor does the cause of the widow come before them. He told them to be compassionate toward, among other things, the widowed, the fatherless, the stranger, the foreigner, and they hadn't done it. Now, they went to church, they attended Bible class. What they were passionate about was their rituals. They were not passionate about God. The object of their passion was not God, it was their rituals. And because they lacked a passion for God, they lacked compassion for people. Man, those six words really struck me. When I walked out of the auditorium at the Preston Road Church of Christ in Dallas, I'd finished up a workshop, and so I had a chance to go somewhere else that Sunday evening, and I chose to go there. When I walked out of the auditorium, on the wall, something was real obvious and caught my attention. Now, it had to have been designed by a woman because it was good. It was really good. It was beautiful. I have a picture of it in my phone. This beautiful, attractive wall, and on that wall were six words. Passion for God. Compassion for people. That's right religion in the sight of God right there. But what happened with the Jewish people is they had morphed into a passion for their rituals and they lacked compassion for people. And when Jesus arrives on the scene, the Jewish leaders were indicted for devouring widows' houses. In Acts chapter 6 and verse 1, the neglect of the widow is mentioned, and I want to ask you to reflect on something. And what prompted my thinking was Brother Wayne Jackson's commentary on the book of Acts. When you get to Acts chapter 6, you know, you're at a unique juncture here in this amazing story of this thriving church. Now, in Acts chapter 2, there are thousands who become Christians. Now, they've come from all over the inhabited world. Now, they're also stuck there. Well, I hate to use the word stuck. You know, they're there way longer than they intended, right? This was not your normal Pentecost. You know, they go with plans of going like they usually go and coming back when they usually come back. But something happens. The Holy Spirit comes with power and things are totally different. Have you ever gone on a trip and ended up getting stuck way longer than you thought? You had an accident or maybe some sort of injury or a sickness and you end up having to stay way longer? That's what's happening to these thousands of people. Now, people from all over the inhabited world, when you read about the number of disciples being added to and you read about the multiplying of the disciples, Brother Wayne Jackson suggests that probably by the time you get to Acts 6, verse 1, you're probably talking about 20,000 disciples. Now, I don't know about Robert or any other preacher in this room, but I would not want to be the preacher at a 20,000 member church. I wouldn't want to be an elder there either, or a deacon. Do you know what you've got when you've got 20,000 people together? You've got one mass of a mess. They're not only 20,000 people, there are 20,000 people there that are there way longer than they had intended. Now imagine the logistical nightmare it was for them addressing one another's needs in that unique situation. And yet there's no mention of a ministry weakness in regard to that time. You've got this radically increasing number of disciples. And the first mention of a ministry weakness in the first century church is about the widowed. That's the first one mentioned. I doubt if it was the first one experienced, but it's the first one mentioned. Now, in those days when the number of the disciples was multiplying, there arose a complaint against the Hebrews by the Hellenists because their widows were neglected in the daily distribution. And what did the Lord want? He wanted that taken care of. So there were appropriate people appointed to take care of that need because it wasn't right to neglect the needs of the widowed. Well, this verse here is one sentence. I'm going to take you back to English class, and I'm going to ask you to look at that sentence, and we're thinking out loud together, and this is English class. Give me the subject of the sentence. No modifiers, just the subject. Religion, one word. Now, the English word religion comes from a Latin word, religare, which means to bind again or bind back. It's very close to the New Testament concept of reconciliation. Make friends again is the idea of reconciliation. We sin, we become enemies with God. Through Jesus Christ, we can be reconciled to God, brought back together again. Religion is not a four-letter word. Count the letters. It's also not a bad word. In our culture, religion has become a bad word. People talk about not wanting anything to do with religion. Now, what kind of religion is being talked about here? There are modifiers. What are the modifiers? Okay. Now, if this is talking about pure and undefiled religion, what does that imply? That there's what? Impure and defiled religion. Now, which one do you want to practice? Obviously, pure and undefiled. Now, in whose opinion or whose perspective are we talking about here? Are we talking about the Pope? Are we talking about some synod or conference or a bunch of preachers? Whose view is being discussed here? God's. Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father. Now, there's three verbs in the sentence. Who can identify the three verbs? Is, visit, and keep. Okay. Now, let's go with the last one first. Keep what? Keep ourselves unspotted from the world. Why would that be included? Every time I read that passage, I think about Isaiah chapter 6. And I think about what an awesome experience it had to be Isaiah, to see what he saw. That's recorded for us in Isaiah chapter 6. To see God on the throne? What was that like? And then to hear those words, and I can't help but wonder, bass, baritone, tenor, what was the holy, holy, holy. He was blown away. He was just blown away by that experience. He realizes how sinful he is and how sinful the people that he is that he's among. He's blown away by being introduced in a unique way to the holiness of God. Our moral problems in the church are at its root caused by people not appreciating or understanding the awesomeness of the holiness of God. If we could reflect more on the holiness of God, we'd have a lot less problem with temptation and sin. It's when we have that passion for God, for that holy God, you know, that holy God that we want to perfect His holiness in our life, we're going to be able to handle our temptations and the sin that's all around us a whole lot better. Now, this word keep is in the present tense. It's actually the idea of keep on keeping ourselves unspotted from the world. Now, the other one, the verb in the middle is visit. Now, that verb is, if you were to take the transliterated out of Greek into English letters, if you were to take visit, this is what that word looks like. Now, if you take the word bishop and you do the same thing, what you're going to see is you're going to see two words that look very similar when they're transliterated. That's because they are very similar. A bishop is an overseer. This visiting is not just talking about some mere social call. This is talking about looking over and inspecting a situation for the purpose of addressing the needs in that set of circumstances. That's what that word visit is talking about. Now, take that back and look here. Visit, now there's objects of that verb. See, there's an object to the verb keep oneself unspotted from the world. Now the word visit has two objects. What are the two objects? Okay. What have we done in the Lord's church historically to minister to the orphans? Children's homes. Now, they used to be called orphans' homes. As a matter of fact, some of us old geezers or older than dirt people can remember some debates that were conducted, and there was a lot of friction in the brotherhood about this whole business of these orphans' homes or children's homes. Now we call them children's homes. Now, why do we have those children's homes? Okay. What's going on with those children? Boy, they're in serious need, aren't they? James had dreams and nightmares. His young life consisted of horrific physical and mental abuse. As a baby, James' dad would get drunk and beat him unconscious. His mom was usually too high on drugs to protect James or herself. His parents divorced, but James's nightmares continued. Needing her fix on drugs, his mother had several men in and out of her life. At the age of 4, James was sexually abused by one of these men. Desperately wanting the man to stop hurting him, James stopped taking baths in hopes that he would be too foul to be around. When the state finally removed James from his home at the age of 5, he was malnourished, lacked social skills, and even basic verbal skills. He was scared physically and mentally from years of abuse. While things improved slightly, James was moved from foster home to foster home, providing no sense of stability or security. It was impossible for him to trust or to attach himself to anyone. At age 13, James came to Tennessee Children's Home. The kids that we're helping and ministering to are in need. They're technically not orphans. They're kids at risk. Some of them have mental issues. Some of them come from dysfunctional families. Some of them have even been abused physically. We are lovingly, compassionately taking them in, and we are ministering to them. And a lot of those cases, we're ministering to them to try to get them, in our work with their families, to get them reunited with their families. It's compassion. Because of passion for God, we have compassion for people. And boy, that's a uniquely challenging time. So vulnerable, so innocent, so weak. They need help. Now, there's a second object to the same verb. I never thought about that until about 3 weeks after my wife died. And I was a mess. And I started looking for help for widowed people, ministries. I got my laptop out and I started doing research. And guess what I found? Virtually nothing. I thought, man, somebody needs to do something. So I sold my kids, my family, on the concept of the Widowhood Workshop Ministry. Now, I am not naive. I know how this happened. One of my 3 daughters called the other 2 and said, if we don't buy in, he's going to be staying 4 months at your house, 4 months at my house. We would be a lot better served by joining him in this ministry. And it's worked out pretty good since then. During the I was at the 32-year mark with the Hartville, Ohio Church when my wife passed away. And during that 32-year period, what I became aware of was how awful it was to suffer loss. I was with the vast majority of those people when they experienced it. I saw those tears and I cried tears with them. I heard their cries. I hated what they were going through. And I preached memorial service after memorial service. But what I was totally ignorant of was life after loss. I'm talking about every day and every night. That's where I was clueless. Until it happened to me. And man, was it ever a struggle. Cheryl Wayne, do you have the voice to be able to tell them about the three C's? Stand up and holler. You're a former elementary school teacher. You can do this.
They can all get a good laugh for sure. I've waited all these years for the voice to change. It goes up instead of down. Brother Dean and I were here on the campus at Freed for the lectureships about 2 years ago. We were at the booth. Some of you have come by the booth and visited with us before. And this brother came by. We were standing talking. And he said, you know, we in the Church of Christ are wonderful with the three C's. Well, Dean and I looked at each other like, where's this going? He said, well, for 2 weeks, we're great with the condolences, the cards, and the casseroles. And after that, we're done. Think about it.
I never knew how hard it was to live after loss. Because you can't move on from your loss. That's not possible. It's a part of your story. You can't delete it out of your story. You can delete stuff on your computer. You can't delete that out of your story. You've suffered loss. What we have to learn to do is move forward with our loss as a part of our story, and even learn to use it for the glory of God by helping other people. Now, I'm not going to suggest that the church is primarily responsible for the widowed, because that's not God's plan. What God's plan is for the family to be the first line of ministry to help the widowed. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 3 beginning, it says, honor widows who are really widows. Well, that's kind of insulting, because that makes you wonder if you are really a widow or not a widow. But it's explained in the context. Honor widows who are really widows, but if any widow has children or grandchildren, there's the distinction. But if any widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show piety at home and to repay their parents, for this is good and acceptable before God. Now, at verse 16, which is the end of a paragraph here, in verse 16 of that same chapter, it says, if any believing man or woman has widows, let them relieve them. The idea is give aid to there. Let them relieve them, and do not let the church be burdened, that it may relieve those who are really widows. Well, W.E. Vine, in his Expository Dictionary of New Testament Words, suggests that it seems like in this context, because you go all the way from verse 3 to verse 16, where this is an area where an inspired writer is zoning in on this theme. He says, a tendency, apparently, to shelve individual responsibility at the expense of church funds. And God's using Paul and saying, no, that's not the way we're going to roll as my family. Now, right smack dab in the middle of this passage, there's a passage that I often quoted and made a secondary application almost out of context. Well, at times out of context. Verse 8, you've heard this verse a bunch of times. But now remember, this is right smack dab in the middle of a conversation about the widowed. Verse 8 says, but if any does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Now, I often quoted that passage encouraging men to get a good job and support their families. Secondary application, but definitely not the first one. The verses before verse 8 and the verses after verse 8 are talking about the widowed in the family. But if anyone does not provide for his own what? His own widowed parent or grandparent. I did not minister to my own mother as well as I could have and should have, because I never read one book about widowhood and what it was like. If I had, I would have been a better son. I was a much better servant of my mother-in-law after my wife passed away than I was my own mother. My mother lived about an hour away from me. And I went down every week during lawn mowing season and cut her grass, and she had the best looking grass on her street. Now, I'm borderline OCD and a recovering control freak, so I was really proud of her yard. And if she needed somebody to take her to the doctor, if she needed somebody to balance that checkbook that would be crazy sometimes, I made it a point to be there. But do you know what she needed more than any of those things? She needed me. because she was living with loss every day and every night. My dad was gone. Now, I had promised my dad before he died, "Dad, if anything ever happens to Mom, I'll make sure that Mom is taken care of." But I didn't realize what she was going through, so I really didn't do the best of jobs. It wasn't because I didn't care. I'd made that promise, and I was serious about that promise, but I didn't know what life after loss was like. By the way, if you've never become acquainted with this, after we take a break, this last session this morning, you'll know. When you leave here, you'll know what that's like. Let me tell you about a time I had with my mother after she had orthopedic surgery. Now, I need to explain that I'm the second of four boys. We were really not good boys. Now, you got to remember, we didn't start going to church till I was 15 years old. So I was raised a heathen. That's basically the way I describe it. And so I'm the second of four boys. My mom's had orthopedic surgery. She's in her private room in the rehab. I'm going to let you enjoy a moment of silence, and I'm going to say what she said. "I wish I would have had a daughter." Now, internally, here's my reaction. "Mom, what am I, chopped liver? I'm here. Come on." But God graced me with exceptional self-control on that occasion, and I said nothing. I usually say things way too quickly and eat my words, but I didn't. Now, I'm going to let you enjoy a couple more moments of silence, and after a couple more moments of silence, I'll tell you what I said to her. "Mom, I wished you would have had a daughter too." Man, was I proud of myself. That was a stroke of genius. That was the perfect thing to say in that situation. And I was sincere. I would have traded those three brothers in a heartbeat for one daughter, for my mama, and for me to have a sister. I used to think that I was cheated by the Lord because I had no sisters. And then it dawned on me after years of thinking about this, I have a whole church full of sisters and I didn't have to go through puberty with them. This is awesome. This is great. What people need who have suffered great loss is they need exactly what the song says. You can go to YouTube, plug this in the search bar. People need people. People need people. It's a beautiful song. Powerful lyrics. As a matter of fact, Riley and Emma, 2 years ago, sang that song to a big group of widowed folks at our annual widowhood retreat. People need people. We need people when we're enjoying great blessings, and we need people when we're dealing with really difficult times in our life. And some of the best blessings in our life are the people in our life that God gives us, gifts us providentially. But I didn't realize how much my mom needed me until my wife died. What are we going to do about ministering to the widowed, the people who have suffered most likely the greatest loss of their life? By the way, did you know this is Dr. Seuss Day? It is. It's Dr. Seuss Day. And the Widowhood Workshop Ministry has not canceled him. Unless someone like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing is going to get better. It's not. That's just reality. And so as Robert pointed out at the very outset of our time together this morning, Roy and Jan Sharp drove a few others up to Murray City, Tennessee. I sat and showed them a PowerPoint of what we were doing at Murray City, Tennessee in regard to ministering to the widowed. And they brought that home and tweaked it and launched what now is the Wings program here. Caring is great, but we also need to know what people are going through if we're going to minister to them effectively. So we're going to take another 5-6 minute break, and then when you come back, I'll give you an opportunity to visit into the head and the heart of a widowed person. Because when you become more acquainted with what goes on in the head and heart of a widowed person, you'll be able to see that a lot of times the other things that we lose that are really special in our lives can be very similar to what a widowed person experiences after their loss. Not the same, but somewhat similar. I want to remind you about the card. I hope that you put your name, first and last name, on that card. And if you've not, please do that now. I'll have my grandkids go around and collect these cards because we do have a couple things that we would like to give away at the end. Let's take a break. Thank you for your attention.